the Baker Street Babes are pleased to announce the return of our annual charity ball, the Daintiest Thing in a Dressing Gown Pajama Party. Yes, that's right, a pajama party. Join a onesie-clad Arthur Conan Doyle and come in your finest Deerstalker jammies, dressing gowns, onesies, and fluffy stash slippers. This is open to all Sherlockians and their friends. The event includes a buffet dinner, cash bar, live music, fantastic prizes, and delightful entertainment. Hosted by William Gillette, the charity ball will once again take place at the Players Club, Thursday, January 14th at 8 p.m. Tickets for the event are available at daintiestpjparty.brownpapertickets.com. 100% of the proceeds will benefit the Disabled American Veterans Trust. They strive to provide physical and psychological support programs for the wounded and disabled veterans and their families. We are requesting if any of you fine citizens of the internet are inclined to clean out any Sherlockian-oriented closets or donate original pieces of art and crafts, we would be thrilled and honored to accept the donations for our live and silent auctions. Shipping becomes very difficult during the holiday season, so if anyone has an item to contribute or a suggestion to make, we are all ears, and we'll promptly give you our mailing address or collect the object at a Sherlockian event in the NYC area. The Baker Street Journal is a leading Sherlockian publication, with features written by the readers for the readers. It contains both academic articles and light, fun reading for any sort of Sherlock Holmes enthusiast. If you're a fan of The Great Detective, The Good Doctor, and the other works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and you'd like to know more about the journal, how to subscribe, or how to offer your own services at writing an article, their website is www.bakerstreetjournal.com.
Wessex Press, an imprint of Gazzardine Books, is a premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. They are also our publishers for One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, A New Generation on Sherlock Holmes. It was edited by several of the Baker Street Babes and contains a foreword by Laurie R. King, the author of the Mary Russell series. Another brilliant book published with Gazzardine Books is Matthias Boström and Matt Laffey's Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle in the Newspapers. If you'd like to know more about Wessex Press, Gazzardine Books, or our publication, please go to www.wessexpress.com.
This podcast contains spoilers. I'm serious. Major spoilers. Spoilers so big, you will fall off a waterfall and realize you took a drug overdose. Shit.
Oh, they call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street Babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh, so when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 2-2-1
All right, welcome to Baker Street Babes, episode 70, Reaction to the Abominable Bride. Podcasting with you is Amy and
Ashley
and Sarah.
Okay, so as we kind of do with our reactions, we are going to go through the episode. First of all, I think that we all liked it a lot.
That's fair to say.
Yeah.
Might be a slight understatement. Only a little
just
one.
Just a little.
Yeah, my current reaction is flailing my arms.
There may have been some flailing here.
And a bit of shrieking. And
so unseemly.
Oh, yes. Mr. Holmes would not approve. Okay. Well, maybe he would, considering the theme of this episode.
I don't know. I think in that checked suit, he might have approved of basically anything.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so we should say that. Cavers is not with us, but she did want to declare her appreciation for the check suit, because, I mean...
I was taking notes as I went along, and one of my notes literally reads, "Really, Sherlock, that check suit? Are you sure?" That's the whole note to myself.
It actually reminded me of the newer Russian Holmes, which there are very few things in Sherlock that ever remind me of the new Russian Holmes. That was very much like something that would have been worn in that series. Okay. So I know you took notes kind of on the structure of the episode. Obviously, as with Sherlock as a whole, this episode was very complex.
Right.
So we will do our best to kind of run through, and if we remember stuff, then we'll just jump back.
And for the record, to everybody listening, this is going to be hugely spoilery. So if you haven't seen it yet, don't listen to this.
Oh, we should
turn back now.
Yes, we are going to get it up as soon as possible, but yes, this is for people who have seen it and want to squee with us. If you have not seen it, stop immediately and go watch it, because why are you waiting?
Okay. Right.
All right, so we began with that what's happened on Sherlock so far montage, which I have to say I was thinking, this is an interesting way to start an episode set in the Victorian period.
I agree. I was like, this wasn't part of our timeline, so why are they giving us all this stuff? Of course, the other thing was that it's not like anybody watching doesn't remember all the things that have happened. Because let's face it, nobody's just watched it one time.
Yes.
Or is that just us?
Maybe. I don't know, man. I don't think it's just us.
I don't think it's just us either.
So we had this cool montage, and then...
And then we had a new intro.
Awesome.
Yes.
The intro, I love the new intro, because it mirrored the regular intro, but with, you know, Victorian imagery, which is fantastic.
Yes, it was, as with a lot of things in this episode, a very clever meta, kind of Victorian meta sort of look at the Sherlock world.
Yes.
With some intentional cracks in the sort of time period, which we'll get to.
Yes.
And Lindsay, who is not on the episode, wanted to mention her excitement at their little riff on the Granada theme, which is awesome.
That was beautiful, and even the camera movement at that point from the Baker Street sign down to the street mirrors the Granada intro.
Yes, yes. That was totally awesome. Love it. Okay. I just keep thinking of this in my head and, like, getting derailed in, like, my thoughts because it's just so awesome.
Because you're thinking of the checked suit again?
Well, you know. I mean, swooping out with the checked suit. It is. They wore the clothing and the hats well, I have to say.
I love the mustache, I'm not gonna lie. I really liked the mustache a lot.
Yes.
I know it's controversial, but I'm just gonna go ahead and say it. I'm gonna declare on the pro mustache side.
Pro mustache, yes. I mean, you know, sometimes the out of control illustrator can be awesome.
The illustrator had no idea what Watson looked like in the Strand. He has made him up every time. Paget had no clue. He was just like, he's just a guy in a mustache. Nobody will remember.
Yeah, exactly.
It's got sillier and sillier. And speaking of facial hair, another one of my early notes was when Lestrade walked in.
Oh, boy.
And I was just so happy about the mutton chops.
The mutton chops. Okay, so we should talk about, though, this sort of thing that I was not expecting at all, which is this very short AU of the beginning of the Sherlock series,
yes.
Basically.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it kind of created a way to pastiche what we know of the modern Sherlock into the backstory of this Victorian Sherlock, so that we could actually establish the timeline and where we were in their relationship.
Right, right.
So it started there, and I was like, oh, are we going to get the origin story? That's weird. That's not at all what I was expecting.
Right.
And then it immediately jumped to the mention of the Blue Carbuncle, which,
right.
You know, people who know Sherlock know that the Blue Carbuncle is not really early on. The Blue Carbuncle is 1893? I'm not going
right.
to get that right.
It established us closer to where we would expect it to be in the timeline.
Yeah, and then mentioned the hound. So
right.
then we knew we were...
The dog one.
Yep, the dog one. The dog one.
Well, and it was interesting because we had certain, you know, certain people in their same places, certain people in different places. Like, we didn't see Molly in that in the very beginning of that, which was great because we got a great reveal later. But, yeah, so we kind of have this and clever use of canon quotes there, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yes.
Watson is narrating his entry to London and situation. Very similar to the John Watson. It was actually reminding me of how true to the spirit modern Sherlock is. That origin being so very close to the same thing.
Sure, that they can just jump into it, and it feels it bridges the gap
pretty
nicely.
So we jump over to the Blue Carbuncle, which puts us much later in time, and we have Watson saying, years have passed, et cetera, et cetera, and we have this incredibly amusing exchange, which was in the trailer, one of the many trailers, about this sort of hilarious meta conversation they're having about Dr. Watson's stories.
Mm. I love it. And I love that Mrs. Hudson is still fucking hilarious. And she's going on a strike because she doesn't get any lines in the stories, and she's just really cross that she doesn't ever get to say anything.
It seems like a hilarious throwaway, and actually turns out to be a beginning of a theme that obviously carries through this episode of, you know, femininity and feminism and women's roles in the Victorian era, which was not what I was expecting and was incredibly fascinating.
Hilarious
at this particular time.
It's interesting. I mean, as we learn in the reveal by the end, all of this is happening inside modern Sherlock's mind, which means that all of the characters and all of the relationships and all of the behaviors are actually his sort of unconscious perceptions of them, and also a recognition of how he treats them, which is really interesting because Victorian Sherlock is actually much more respectful toward the abilities of other people, which leads us to believe that something that I'm sure a lot of fans already believe, which is that modern Sherlock is actually not nearly as rude as he wants us to think that he is.
Absolutely. That is one of the most interesting things about this to me, because obviously they had trolled us this whole time and tried to convince us that there was not going to be this amount of connection.
Right.
So clearly, to connect it to this level, we have slightly nicer, at least, Sherlock in Sherlock's own brain, which is very interesting.
Yeah. But not his sort of conscious brain that have how he perceives himself. His unconscious drug-addled brain, which is possibly more close to how he really is and what he really believes about people, which is that he really believes that Watson is much cleverer than he tells him he is, and he really believes that he's much less clever than he thinks, than he suggests he is. So,
well, and also that it kind of teases out his very complicated attitude toward women, which is interesting.
Mm.
I mean, this is much later and we'll get there, but Janine's presence I found particularly interesting.
Well, all the women. My note actually said all the wronged women of modern Sherlock turn up in that scene. Like they've just all been gathered together, and it's just a recognition of all these silenced voices, as Mrs. Hudson is. The what?
The Moffat apology.
The Moffat apology. It's a good start. It's a good start, Moffat. Keep working on it.
All right. So we have obviously, as you said, we had Lestrade coming in with his awesome facial hair, and we have this really neat scene where Holmes and Watson are kind of deducing back and forth about his sort of emotional state and reason for being there.
Hmm. And Watson gets the upper hand.
Yes.
Which should have been a clue that we were in Sherlock's mind, because everybody is going to seem a little bit smarter if it's Sherlock's version of them, probably.
Excellent point. That is a very good point.
But I did love the line, "Give him a drink to restore the courage of Scotland Yard."
How is it? Yes! Oh, yes! Well, and it was, later in the canonical timeline, we have a less acerbic relationship between Holmes and Lestrade, too.
Sure.
So I feel like that, obviously, again, we're very meta, we're in Sherlock's mind palace, drug-addled, whatever, but it is a little bit of a nod to the fact that relationship is built by this point. And he mentions other Scotland Yard detectives, which is also fun.
Right. And the other thing is that the line, the compliments of the season line, is actually, that's drawn from Blue Carbuncle, actually. That's what he says to Peterson, I think.
Oh, Mary. Ooh. We can't leave out Mary's little fake out.
Of being the Veiled Lodger?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Nice. Yeah, we also get a much clearer idea of how Sherlock perceives Mary, which is that he really respects her a lot.
Kind of a nod to the end of Sign of Four, a little bit.
Right.
Yes, awesome moment of also beginning sort of one of our main themes of role of women in feminism.
Mm-hmm. Well, she gets mentioned that she's a suffragette, and I mean, of course she is.
And
of course, she
stays behind and also gets her own mysterious summons after the gentlemen have left, which is fun.
Right. And she's cross about staying behind, and she has a little discussion with Mrs. Hudson about being left behind and how it's rubbish. Fair.
Well, and it speaks to their different desires. Mrs. Hudson wants to have a bigger role in terms of her own sort of sphere as the landlady, and Mary wants to actually be part of the adventures, so it's kind of an interesting
right. Right.
All right, so we are... The game is afoot.
And not on. The game is afoot. That was fun. I actually noticed right away when we first get the introduction of the Abominable Bride thing, the first thing I noticed was, oh, she kills herself the same way Moriarty does.
Yes.
And as soon as she was, quote-unquote, not really dead, the note that I wrote myself right away when she murdered her husband was, if she's not really dead and she killed herself the same way as Moriarty, the story of her survival will be the clue to how he also survived. So I was really proud of myself. Like, as the story unfolded, I just felt, you know, those moments where you outsmart the people and you're like, haha, I figured it out before you told me you were supposed to let me figure it out. So I was really pleased. So I just thought I'd toot my own horn for a second.
Oh, definitely. Very good. No, I mean, I think they did a lot to try to sort of show us that, but misdirect us.
Right.
Very quickly afterward. But yes, there was a strong, well, and we began to sort of get these lines about things, ghosts we make for ourselves, things that were a little indicative of something beyond, you know.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't going to be, it wasn't really going to be a ghost story. It couldn't be.
No.
It's just not what Sherlock is.
But a very interesting mystery, which actually reminded me of the first Guy Ritchie film when, Mark Strong's character is dead, not dead.
Right, right.
But yeah, so we have, if I'm not missing anything major, you can stop me if I am, but we have this awesome visit to the morgue.
Yeah, that definitely comes next.
Oh, yeah.
in which Anderson continues to suck at everything. Because in Sherlock's mind, even though he has basically redeemed his relationship with everybody else in his mind, Anderson continues to just be awful.
He's lowering the IQ of the whole block.
He is. Yes. He is. Really? Really? You're not gonna, really? No, nobody noticed she was a woman? No? Not at all? Are you sure?
Yeah, so.
Okay.
Obviously, we see why we had not seen a lot of Victorian Molly up to this point, because awesome reveal. We have
a stash.
Super with her awesome, yeah.
She wears it as well as Watson.
She does. And again, we have clever Watson.
Right.
Who notices something, and particularly notices something about Molly, which I thought was an interesting thing for Sherlock to have in his mind, that he's the one who's always missed the thing about Molly that was right in front of him.
Huh. Yeah, that's fair. I hadn't thought about that. That's good. Yeah. I also love the whole discussion about twins and how it's not twins, but it could be twins, but maybe it's secret twins and it's never twins, but it might be super secret twins. No, really, it's really not twins. It's really not twins, but it might be, but it isn't. And as soon as that whole conversation happened, I don't know about you, but the whole time I kept going, oh my God, it's going to be twins, isn't it? Please don't let it be twins.
I know. I was thinking that too, but it reminded me of sort of a nod to some of Watson's less bright moments, because we did have such a clever Watson overall, but we had this, like, Watson is so stuck on this, like, hilarious secret twin thing.
It might be secret twins, you don't know.
It's never lupus.
It's never lupus. You know what? But in the Rupert Everett movie, it was totally secret twins.
Yep.
So, it could be.
You never know.
But it's not.
Okay.
We also got a little, I mean, we've had little nods to other stories all the way through, but the blood that wasn't there earlier on the finger was totally Norwood Builder. Just thought I'd throw that out there. And writing on the wall, of course, to study in Scarlet.
And Molly gets to yell at Anderson all the time.
Which is fantastic. That is fantastic.
That was a favorite, I have to say. I was like, go Molly. Or Cooper.
Cooper. Yeah. I liked that when we got the telegram, we got the continuation of the technique that they use for showing texts on the screen, but it was typing to make it a telegram.
Oh, yes.
I thought that was just really cute.
Absolutely loved several directorial sort of nods to things that I wouldn't have necessarily thought they could incorporate the way that they did.
Yeah. It's interesting because it shows that the choices they made in the modern series are really, they could have been choices, that the same choices that they would have made had they made the series Victorian to begin with.
Oh, that's a good point. That's very good.
So things that you go, oh, well, now see, it's so modernized because they're texting, but really, you know, it would have worked the same way.
Just a little slower.
Yeah. And the next scene we get is the Diogenes Club.
Before
we get to Mycroft, I have to say, could somebody out there, whoever's listening, somebody, please write the adventure of the Bluefishmonger, because that was just the whole sign language-y thing, the Bluefishmonger. Oh my god, that's just brilliant.
I think we're gonna get, I'm glad you like my potato on a t-shirt.
Yes. That has already happened. That's already happened.
I mean, there are no words. I mean, if you've seen it, you know. And if you haven't, why are you listening to
this?
That's
right.
So, you know.
Correct.
Then the obviously major character that we had not seen and were all waiting with bated breath to see exactly what we saw, which is Victorian Mycroft and all of his girthy.
Girthy. Yeah. So we get traditional Mycroft. Mycroft, you know, canon Mycroft, of course, is very fat and sloth-like. And this is beyond fat and sloth-like. I mean, this is a Mycroft that has, well, he's really let himself go. One too many plum puddings. Or two. Or ten.
Yeah, this is a Mycroft who doesn't care to the point that he's, like, gonna eat as much as he can before he kicks off. Like,
right.
This is a level of not, I mean, I think it speaks to the very extreme canon version where he, like, never leaves his little, you know, house and office. And
sure.
Whatever. Yeah.
So. But again, this is the version of Mycroft that is in Sherlock's head. So the question is, why does Sherlock conceive of Mycroft as this person? Is that an extreme representation of his kind of psychological gluttony or power hungry quality or his
like
need to control everything, even his food? You know, I.
Oh, that's really. Oh, that's a deep, Ashley.
Oh.
It's like he's almost like maybe in the modern one, he's obviously lost weight, but he's substituted one compulsion for some other compulsion mm-hmm. or power or something like that
mm-hmm.
at his own risk. It's interesting to me that in Sherlock's mind, Mycroft is as risky as he is or riskier.
Sure.
Which in those... Go ahead, Sarah. Sorry.
Well, he'll do anything to prove that he's more right than Sherlock, including killing himself faster.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. That's sibling rivalry at a whole new level.
Yeah, they're not exactly at a more functional place in their relationship than they were in modern series. Or are. Okay.
So. Also, wasn't Gatiss adorable in his suit? In his fat
goodness,
suit.
Yes. Totally like Humpty Dumpty over there.
I would give Mark Gatiss a hug, both as a normal person and as giant fat Mycroft. I would give him a hug too.
That had to be somewhat uncomfortable, so props to him for giving his all.
Yes. See. I enjoyed, as an off, Watson listing off all the people who could possibly just cause a whole bunch of problems. Like, who are the scariest people in the world? Socialists. No, not socialists.
Oh,
anarchists.
My word.
The French. Suffragists. That was his list. Yes, Serbians. Perfect.
Yeah, that was hilarious. It shows us sort of Watson's less progressive tendencies.
Sure, sure.
Which we also see toward women in this episode.
Right, yeah.
So we have the connection with the bride, but we don't exactly know what it is yet, and we have the presentation of this sort of mystery that Mycroft has solved that he's not going to tell us the answer to, and also this leading into a client approaching Sherlock in the very traditional Victorian way.
Mm. Yeah. And then we have the entrance of the new client. Yeah. This, can't remember her name. It's already gone.
I was thinking that. I will say, if, let me look it up. I love it because my favorite canon story is the Copper Beeches.
Mm.
And one of my favorite things, just little kind of things in here, is later on when they're having the conversation about Holmes's lack of romantic entanglements, and Watson is talking to him about liking this woman, it reminded me very much of Watson's sort of attitude in the Copper Beeches, that he doesn't understand why Holmes doesn't pursue this woman that Watson thinks he obviously likes.
Right, right. She's no longer interesting when she's no longer a puzzle.
I'm looking at cast and crew, and it looks like we do not have a full... Oh dear, I feel fail. Lady,
Started with a C. It definitely was a C. Let's just make something up.
I know, I mean, because let me see if it's... Because I know we had,
Well, she's married to Eustace somebody or other, played by Tim McInerney. So we can just call her Mrs. Tim McInerney. I love Tim McInerney. I was so happy when it was him. So
Carmichael.
Mrs. Carmichael. Carmichael. I know it was a C. I was going to go with Claremont or Cunningham. Carmichael. So Mrs. Carmichael comes with the case, which begins with her husband getting a packet of orange pips, which of course we would recognize from the canon. Yes.
I feel that at that point, if you hadn't thought there was a Moriarty connection, surely that would have clued it in because of the Great Game.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
And we have sort of a little encapsulated almost story of the five orange pips that has sort of a similar outcome, though obviously with a very different cause. Which has the outcome of the client ending up dead.
Right. Which is what happens in the story, of course. Right. He turns up drowned in a puddle or something. So that was one of Holmes' less auspicious cases when he the five orange pips does not go well for anybody, really. Because they turn up and Holmes is like, oh, well, sure, I'll investigate. Why don't you go home? And then he drowns in a puddle. So
yeah, it's not the greatest.
It's not the best story in the canon.
It's arguably more fun as a component of a larger story, which we have here.
Yay. I think just having a couple of pips is a better story than the actual five orange pips.
Yes. So we have them traveling, obviously, to the country for this.
Oh, with that wonderful tableau from Silver Blaze, the Paget illustration.
Yeah.
Which, of course, was also recreated in Granada. And so I love it. I would love for somebody to screen cap all the times that an adaptation has done a tableau of that illustration and just put them all together. Are you listening, interwebs?
Tumblr, we're counting on you.
Tumblr, don't let us down. And that's where we first get the, when he leaves the train, we first get the full shot of the checked suit in all its glory.
Oh my goodness.
And all the rest of the action stops. And I forgot what the whole case was about
it's like a slow-mo model catwalk shot. Like, comes out all this glory.
Oh, God. Why? Why did they choose that? That's... Sure. Whatever. Why not? Checked suit. I'm sure it seemed like a good idea at the time. And the time was, you know...
Oh, okay. Yeah, so that happened. And we also should mention hatware, which is actually quite awesome throughout. We have top hat, we have multiple hats, not just the deerstalker being worn at inappropriate times, which adaptations have done in the past.
Though that was there, but they made a mental, they clearly were like intentionally making it inappropriate.
Yes.
It's like your Sherlock Holmes, wear the damn hat.
Yes. Yes, we had a lamp shading of that.
Yep. Yep.
So we have then more investigation of the case. Talking to this guy, he isn't very cooperative. Says he doesn't know anything about this ghost that's haunting him, etc.
Yeah, the clients never like to let on. You know, the point where you go, no, I'm going to be investigating your murder, and they still let you go, that client's not going to make it very far. What are you doing, Tim McInerney? What are you doing?
Yeah, poor Tim.
Look at your life. Look at your choices.
I mean, he had awesome facial hair. We can give him that.
He did, and he was Tim McInerney, so things could have turned out better for him, but they didn't.
So clearly, as we expect, he doesn't make it. We have this kind of nighttime thing where Watson is kind of awesomely brave and then kind of scared out of his wits.
Well, before that happens, we get the vigil. Can't leave out the vigil, because that's when they have the really awkward conversation where Watson's trying to be a human being and Holmes is just like, Why are you words? Just stop.
Well, and that's an interesting, again, knowing that this is happening in Sherlock's mind.
Yeah.
That he himself seems to be sort of mystified as to how he got to be the way he is. It's like, finally he's just like, I'm going to shoot you, and I'm responsible for who I am, so we're not having this conversation.
He's questioning his own origin story. He's like, how did I get to be this huge asshole? What happened? I'm not really sure. You know what? I don't even want to ask myself that question anymore. Right. Me? Right. Version of me that is Watson's face but is really me? Shut up.
Yeah, that's a good... Well, and we kind of get a few different references. We have the Irene Adler reference there. We have the, like I said, sort of Copper Beach's reference. We have references to different... This sort of question of his canonical view toward women sort of happening there, which of course relates to the episode overall, too.
Sure, and also relates to the interaction that he has in Baker Street with Moriarty, which is we'll get to in detail, but it's very homoerotic and not sort of unintentionally. And that's also in Sherlock's mind, so, you know, for what that's worth.
Yeah, there's a lot of different things that are relationally kind of being teased out there.
Yep.
So
during that vigil... Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to remark on the fact that the picture of Irene that he has is the modern picture of Irene. If you look at her, you can tell that she is not dressed in Victorian-era garb.
So we start to get the future bleeding through, which then, from that point on, continues to happen a couple times with different words that people say that should start to tip us off. That something more is going on. But I love during that vigil, it reminded me of the Speckled Band, for sure. Yes. And also, the Granada episode, and it's escaping me, it may have been Six Napoleons, the one where Lestrade was there, and Watson offers him a humbug, and Holmes says, Watson, this is no time for humbugs. Which is one of my favorite lines in the entirety of the Granada series, and I really, really was hoping all the way through, I was like, please bring out a humbug, please eat a humbug, oh my god, eat a humbug, and he didn't.
There were so many references, they so should have done that.
I feel like that was the biggest missed opportunity for me in the entire episode, was not having that humbug happen.
You know.
But you can't have everything.
Can't have everything. We had almost everything. Yes, so we have this awesome awkwardness where at the time it was really funny, and then later on we learned that it's in Sherlock's brain, and it's still funny, but really strange to think about.
Well, and I think a lot of it is that this is other people's idea of him, that he is absorbed into sort of his self-concept, this constant, what's wrong with you, why can't you just be normal and have a casual conversation and like women and be normal for once.
Yeah, he seemed to be chastising himself, which I guess is something all people do inside their own brain. Why are you behaving? Why can't you just make that phone call? What is it that, why can't you just approach that person and have a conversation? Stop being a jerk.
Yeah.
But the Sherlock version, where he creates an entire alternate reality to live in so that he doesn't have to actually do that himself.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And by the way, for everybody, the little beep that just went off was Lindsay texting me to say, oh my god, finally got all the way through Jesus Christ on a water cracker. So...
There you have it.
There you have it. Ladies and gentlemen, Lindsay Faye. Oh, it was all in caps as well. Let's see.
So after our vigil, then we get to sort of this kind of action sequence with the ghost of the Obama.
The ghost of New Year's Eve past.
Yes. Exactly.
New Year's past, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, that was, I mean, good action sequence. I mean, it just, it was, that was average to me. Felt a bit odd that Watson left his post. That seemed to be out of character for the real Watson.
Yeah, I mean, we had Watson being brave, but then also being scared. I don't know if maybe that was supposed to start to signal to us that maybe this case is not really the main thing that we're focusing on, considering what it ends up leading into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that, I would say for me, I don't know, Sarah, you might have loved that sequence. I didn't think it was bad. I didn't think it was my personal, like, high point of the episode or anything.
No, it was just acceptable. But you had to have something, you had to have the bride turn up. I mean, the damn episode is named The Bride, so you have to have her show up at some point. You can't just leave cookie crumbs for all the rest of us.
Well, and it was tight in the sense that it did, when he does kind of explain later, we obviously didn't see her face in that sequence. We had the glass was used, the glass was broken. Stuff that you don't know when it's happening the first time is going to figure in later. So I guess, yeah. So that happened.
So there was a thing. It was dark. There was a big house and a ghostly thing, and a guy got stabbed. Tim McInerney got stabbed in the chest, which is too bad.
Yes. And stabbed in the chest, and then there's a note.
There is a note. And the note says, of course, miss me. So we again start to get the future bleeding through. And very shortly after that, there's a reference to pushing a maths professor over a waterfall. And the note I wrote myself was, this Moriarty died at Reichenbach, but the real Reichenbach, but Sherlock knows that Moriarty killed himself with a gun, even in the past, so where are we?
Yes, I was also like, what is this?
Yeah, we have two versions of the same event happening at the same time in the past, and then all of a sudden all hell is breaking loose with the storyline.
Yes, that's when things kind of, we start to realize where, if we hadn't realized it, we're not seeing something that's exactly what we expected.
Right. We get Mycroft uses the analogy, the virus in the data, which is obviously not going to work.
So
anachronistic. Sherlock Holmes says crime scene, and Mycroft even is like, really? Crime scene? What is that? You're just saying words. Those aren't...
Well, and it's almost like Sherlock's brain, as he's getting more emotionally tied to what's going on in his brain, his Victorian world is becoming less and less solid.
Right.
Modern thought is bleeding through. So, like you were saying a minute ago.
Yeah, the more connected he gets and the closer he gets to trying to unravel it, the less brain power he is able to focus on sustaining the illusion.
And these two time periods obviously dovetail closer and closer. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Then we get use of the syringe, so we get the introduction of proper drug use. We've had Watson refer to him as a drug addict earlier, but here he's meditating and he's, he pulls out the syringe. We don't see him use it, but we assume he does.
Right.
And then we get that Moriarty in Baker Street, which we have to assume, even within the context of, right, even within his mind, that was a drug-induced...
Right.
It was in a drug-induced state inside a drug-induced state.
Yes. Is that... Okay, question is... I'm unclear. Is that before or after we have that a sequence with the papers floating?
It's part of the same sequence. So first the papers are floating and Mrs. Hudson is like and Lestrade are peering over and saying, oh, no, he's been like that for days. And then we see him reach for the syringe.
Yeah,
and then when it comes back to him, it's him with Moriarty. Yeah.
I just wanted to say again, that's another type of Mind Palace sequence that is very, very similar to what we've had in the modern series, just using like snippets of newspapers and, period accurate items, which is interesting.
That's true.
Well, and we didn't comment on this, but we also had the really cool sequence when Lestrade is telling them the story, and he kind of mind palaces into it. So they're in the sitting room, and we're actually seeing the Abominable Bride stuff happening too. So I love that as well.
Yes.
Moriarty is in Baker Street.
Moriarty is in Baker Street, and this very sort of—I mean, Moriarty is creepy anyway. Andrew Scott's Moriarty is always a creeper, but here he's even more creepy. This interaction is just very. You know, I've been sneaking into your house, and your bed is very comfortable. Do you know that dust is made of human skin? Oh, let me taste it, you know? And you're just like, well, okay, if that's, are you sure that's what we're doing? Okay, that's what we're doing.
It reminded me more of the Moriarty that was in the sort of Sherlock's death mind palace after he shot the one that's kind of in the straitjacket, where he's gone to, like, a whole other level of crazy.
Right. Right. Well, again, this is the Moriarty in his head, right? So they should match if there's consistency. So Sherlock perceives Moriarty as even more freaking crazy than he actually is the moral of that story.
Yeah, it's like he's representing certain craziness to Sherlock more than he was as an actual person.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, and later, obviously, once we get to the Reichenbach scene, that kind of makes more sense, too. But yeah, yes. So we have this sort of scene with these sort of odd overtones and
undertones and just tones.
Yeah, all the tones.
All the tones. The next three notes I wrote to myself were, all of this is a contrivance so that he could try to figure out how Moriarty is still alive, then all of the versions of the characters are the way he imagines them. The comment that this is when he wakes up. Right, in the plane for the first time.
Right.
And he says, it helps me if I see myself through his eyes, that is Watson's eyes, sometimes I'm so much cleverer. So that helps explain a little bit why in this, this imagined Victorian version, we actually get Watson doing the narrative, the voiceover,
right.
Which is something we don't actually get otherwise.
Right. Yeah, that was an interesting. It was kind of a fun red herring. Obviously, we get clues pretty early on that all is not as it seems. But it's interesting that we have the narrating Watson in Sherlock's mind.
Right.
But that obviously is the succinct explanation for why Sherlock finds that helpful.
Well, all the way through the modern series, we'd seen even when Watson had disappeared, Sherlock continued to talk to him.
Yes.
So Watson already is the voice inside Sherlock's head. We knew that. So this just sort of literalizes that further.
That's very true. There's always a Watson there, even if there's not physically a Watson there.
Right. Then I put, is this a drug-induced dream? And then the next note I have is, really? A secret underground society that's actually under the ground? Fuck me.
Okay, alright, this was very, I have to give a shout out to young Sherlock Holmes, because this is so much like when they discover, like, the pyramid, and there's, like, the secret society, and yeah.
Oh my goodness, yeah, there's definitely that, but it wasn't really, so at least we know it wasn't really that, but the fact that was there, I was just like, it can't be a secret society, it just can't. It can't be a conspiracy with a secret society. Please don't do that. Please, that would be as bad as twins.
Yes.
All the women who'd been treated badly turn up.
Yes, and we get Mary kind of being her sort of awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome, yeah. In that sequence, along with all of the other sort of put-upon ladies of Sherlock.
Right. And then the idea of the double burial, which is back in the present again, back in modern times, Sherlock is obsessively trying to determine the final, the way that she actually died, the way that the bride actually died.
He kind of goes through, like, what he, yeah, he gets obsessed. He sort of solved the case, but he's still obsessed.
And the only way he feels he can figure it out is if he exhumes her body. And the idea is that he expects to find two bodies in the coffin, which is, of course, Lady Frances Carfax.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, there is no second body, and then the skeleton body rises, everybody freaks out, and then crap, we're in the past again. So it was a dream inside a dream inside a dream.
Right.
However, when we're in the past, we get Moriarty. He's still calling him Sherlock. And so that should have been a clue that, again, we're still in another place. We're still inside a story.
Right, right.
So the waking up from the various versions of the dream happens faster and faster the closer to the end we get.
There's kind of an inception thing kind of happening there, where we're in levels of dream state, sort of.
Which is fair. I think probably most people have experienced something where you are in a dream and you realize you're dreaming and you wake up, only to realize you're still dreaming eventually, and then it becomes even harder to wake yourself up. So, I guess something like that is going on, but with cocaine.
Yes.
So there's that.
And possibly other...
Yes.
Given, we have this sort of list motif that we don't at this point yet know what Mycroft is wanting Sherlock to have lists of.
I mean, we assume that it's a list of all the drugs he's taking, so that if he gets found, you know, that they can administer the proper response.
Right, which obviously
response.
We see, whatever.
Right.
So we end up in this very dramatic situation.
We end up in this wonderful Reichenbach, you know, this moment where, I mean, it's Reichenbach really done right, where they're really on the precipice and the water is pounding down on them and they're fighting.
Great tones, almost like a painting or a, you know. Yeah.
And then Watson turns up, which is wonderful. I love it. There's two of you. That's not fair. Haven't you read the stories? There are always two of us.
Reichen Watson.
And Reichen Watson realizes he's in a story. Reichen Watson kills Moriarty. He's the one who shoves him over the edge.
What a meta idea. Watson's friendship that kills the pain and sadness.
Oh, it's so beautiful. This whole thing is just a big sort of psychological study of Sherlock. I mean, it doesn't really accomplish anything else. As far as the story is concerned, we don't move forward with our story in the modern times.
We end up with a cliffhanger where we're like, oh, we're glad Sherlock realized things, but we didn't know.
Yeah, basically, we don't know anything more at the end of this episode than we did at the end of the last episode, other than we've had this wonderful hour and a half long exploration of Holmes's psyche, which is just really interesting if you go back and watch it a couple times, I think.
Well, and the fulfillment of the sort of a circle with Reichenbach, where we have Reichenbach as it happened in the modern series, and then arguably as it should have happened, where Holmes, Watson comes and Holmes is not alone and he includes Watson and et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. Which brings us to the very end of the episode, in Baker Street. We have Victorian Baker Street, which, by the way, we may notice is actually not that much different from modern Baker Street. They didn't have to change the set very much. Mm-hmm. But Holmes says, I've always known I was a man outside of my time. And we get the idea that rather than it being modern Sherlock imagining Victorian Sherlock, it was actually all along Victorian Sherlock imagining modern Sherlock, which is a wonderful kind of turn at the very end. And then the camera pulls out from looking at Holmes standing at the window of Baker Street, Victorian Holmes, and it pulls out and it's modern London. So it creates this wonderful mesh at the very end.
Well, and we have that touching moment in there. It's short, but where Mycroft, who is back to being thin and strong, Mycroft asks Watson to take care of Sherlock, which is quite sweet.
Yes.
Yes. And we also have that sort of funny thing where they're discussing names for the case, which has an important thing that I must mention because Sarah and I both nearly lost our minds.
Oh my god!
Do you want to talk about that?
Yes. One of the potential names mentioned was Monstrous Regiment, which is also a Laurie R. King novel, Monstrous Regiment of Women, which is also very feminist in bent.
Yes, it deals with not exactly a secret society, but a sort of confederation of early feminists.
Early, yeah.
And it was nice if they were going to sort of go that close to her story in some ways for them to give her that that much of a nod. So, yeah. So, love that. Had a little moment with that. If anybody hasn't read that, it comes right after The Beekeeper's Apprentice, and it's an excellent book. It's my favorite of her books, I think.
It is a good one. It's a good one.
All right. So,
well,
we've been through the structure. Do we have more thoughts that we want to make on the episode in general?
I just thought it was great fun. I think it may be one that I rewatch more than any of the others. Which it has a little catching up to do, because I'm not gonna lie. But but it's just so fun, and it, even though it's really well integrated into the rest of the show, which they lied about. They said it wouldn't be, but they lied. We shouldn't be surprised, because they lie about everything. But it works very well as a standalone. So it could be that one that you go to and sit down and watch and not have to think about where it stands in the context of the larger story.
Yeah, I agree. And I also think part of why it would be, in my opinion, rewatchable is that while it is sort of a meditation on Sherlock's psyche, it has a very, like, kind of a very positive kind of triumphant ending. It's not one that is, you know, it's not like rewatching Reichenbach and then having to rewatch the three episodes after because you're really depressed. Not that I would know. You know,
yeah.
A lot of the other episodes we have, you know, we're still seeing, even if this didn't exactly advance us in terms of plot, it definitely advances us in terms of character. We are still seeing a post-Reichenbach Sherlock who is gaining little by little self-understanding. And I think they've done such a good job throughout the whole series of giving us Watson's perspective a lot, but also at times giving us Sherlock's own perspective on himself, which is so interesting because clearly not something we get a lot of in the canon, so...
True. Usually when Sherlock talks about himself, you just go, oh, this is so boring. Please let's tune out because I don't believe anything you're saying about yourself. Yeah, this episode, you're right. It does have a nice triumphant ending. It doesn't, it is a non-shock blanket required episode. So that's nice.
Well, and we now know that he has the whole Victorian world in his head. So, you know, somebody asked him if they were going to do a Victorian Christmas. I think they asked Benedict, and he said he was open to doing that every year if they wanted to.
Yeah, he's got that's true. He's got the whole he's got all of Victorian Sherlock Holmes in his head now. So that's, I hate the Mind Palace a little bit less now because that's what lives in it.
It's his vacation mind palace.
This is mind manor. His mind Victorian manor.
Yes. He has some, I mean, we talked about the suit, but overall, he's got some awesome, awesome wardrobe going on in that mind
universe. Dressing gown.
The dressing gown. Well, I did see mouse and I saw blue. Was there purple? I don't know if there was purple.
I have to watch it again.
It was fun how they pulled in all the characters. I like that as well. Like, everybody found a spot. I mean, even all minor characters that only turned up in one episode or another episode.
Oh, yeah. We got Stanford.
We got
that
Stanford.
Was very
sweet.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, kudos to them. Steven said that they had worked really hard to incorporate this female perspective, and obviously that was a theme. You know, we had sort of the Watson's maid and... Mind Palace Watson underestimating Mary, and which kind of hints at possibly future things to come, but we don't really know. But it was nice just to see characters that we know and love, like Molly, interpreted in such a fun way that was true to her character. So kudos to them for accomplishing that.
I wonder if her being dressed in male garb indicates that Sherlock thinks of her as a kind of asexual being. That's a little depressing for Molly.
I actually thought of that. I wondered if what he was trying to say about his own perceptions versus Watson's is that Watson had always seen her as a whole person or as a woman, and Sherlock had only seen her kind of as her job. But that could be totally wrong. That was just my
opinion. No, I think that's a completely valid reading. Yeah.
Interesting. So much to think about. I mean, I think I'll probably be rewatching it for several times early on just to try to pick up on everything.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a huge amount of analysis that could go into this. I look forward to whoever manages to get the rights to write a book about it first.
Yeah, really. The psychology of Sherlock.
Yep.
And I mean, they've obviously, in the overall context, I mean, we did an episode, obviously, talking about our hopes and dreams for this, which I think it probably exceeded. But, I mean, they've done something that people didn't really think was possible at the beginning of Sherlock, which is taking Sherlock into the Victorian era in a way that was fun and enjoyable and actually fit into the series. So that's impressive.
Yes, it's a very well-constructed work that didn't abandon what the initial sort of premise of Sherlock was, which is the modernization. Kind of continued to do that. And, you know, in the same way that modern Sherlock is a man out of his time, because he always feels like he doesn't belong in, you know, in our time. This Victorian Sherlock is also a man out of his time, which just implies that no matter what time you put Sherlock in, he's never going to fit in because it's not in his nature to fit in.
Well, and we've talked about this ad nauseum, so I won't spend long on it, but it does speak to that comparison with Doctor Who and the sort of man out of time. He can be in any time because he doesn't really fit in any time, kind of a larger-than-life superheroic quality that he has because he's never quite the same as everybody else.
Yep.
Interesting. Sarah, do you have any last thoughts that you want to share?
One little thing that kind of, as I was mulling it over before we started, when Mary is on her phone and has supposedly hacked into MI5 to find out about the end of this case, oof, what do you want to bet she was just on Wikipedia?
Yes, I love that.
I mean,
headcanon accepted.
Unsolved Victorian crime spree / ghost story has internet fans, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, I love the idea that Mycroft is that gullible and that, like, impressed by her, that he just accepts that she's done this. Like, it cracked me up.
And she can tease him that way.
Yes. Excellent headcanon, Sarah.
Yep, that's in there now.
I'll take it.
Well, I don't know about you guys, but, In the real world, nobody is actually listening to this right now when we're making it, but in the real world, in 15 minutes, this is going to air for the first time in the U.S., and we all need to be on our Twitter boxes.
Yes.
So, final thoughts? Any final thoughts? I think those were our final thoughts, but...
Yeah, love it. I mean, anybody listening, you know, tweet us your thoughts, and we would love to talk about it in the next few days, and let us know what you thought.
Absolutely. I'm sure this will sustain plenty of conversation as we join in the long slog to 2017. As we grow ever more weary and infirm.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one?